This is BSA by Design, a podcast about transforming healthcare, educational, and research facilities through expert design and insight. I'm your host once again, Brian Moore. In this episode, we're going to discuss how research facilities are designed and used to feed the world, and what new insights are leading to breakthroughs in this important area, and how collaboration is the key driver to these breakthroughs. Let me introduce our guests, April Agee Carroll, Scott Allen, and Kay Townsend. Dr. April Agee Carroll is an agricultural scientist and operational analytics leader working at the intersection of plant genetics, data science, and research infrastructure. A science fellow with Bayer Crop Science R&D, April previously served as a research director at Purdue University, where she collaborated with BSA on a state-of-the-art greenhouse research center. She brings a unique perspective on how facilities, data, and design come together to enable modern, outcome-driven science. Scott Allen is an architect and the Learning and Discovery Practice Director at BSA. He earned his bachelor's degree in architecture from Virginia Tech. Kay Townsend is a planning principal. Kay earned her Bachelor of Architecture from Ball State University. Welcome to the show. Thanks for joining me, Scott, Kay, April.
Glad to be here.
April, as a first-time guest on the show, I'd like to find out, where's your passion come from for what you do for your career? How did you get into this?
Yeah, that's a great question. I actually started out really loving the act of doing the science itself, being in a lab or working with plants, just anything where, you know, we were really trying to solve hard problems using the scientific method. But pretty early on, I realized that a lot of great science gets stuck, and not because the ideas aren't good, but because the systems around the science and around the people don't work very well. So data's hard to access, yeah. You have facilities that aren't designed for how people actually do research, and teams can be pretty siloed. So that was what really hooked me, was figuring out how to design processes, environments, and systems and tools that help scientists to do the best work, and then, you know, to be able to do it at scale.
Yeah. Well, I'm so glad we could have you on. And I think this group is the right mix to kind of talk about our topic today, which is feeding the future and where science, space, and purpose kind of intersect. And I think you guys can bring so much based just off of your background. So, April, let's start with this. When people think about how the world is fed, they often picture farms, and I grew up working on a farm. So that's where my brain goes. But today, food security starts long before seed hits the soil. So what does feeding the world really mean in 2026?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It starts long before a seed ever reaches a field. So in 2026, we begin feeding the world with an understanding of genetics. We need to understand the DNA that we're working with. We need to understand how traits are inherited. And then we need an ability to test plants in, say, fields, in target environments, or in really precise controlled environments. And then thinking about how we use data to really anticipate how crops will behave in different conditions, particularly under stress. So climate change kind of raises the stakes for that. Feeding the world and food security now depends not just on yield or production as it used to, but more on predictability and resilience.
You mentioned climate change, and climate in general is kind of where I want to go next. How dependent is agriculture still on weather? And how much of that can science now control?
Yeah, we'll always be deeply dependent on the weather as long as we're growing plants outdoors. That hasn't changed, never will. But what has changed is our ability to prepare for the unexpected. So we can't control the weather, but understanding weather patterns, having extreme events kind of as natural experiments, if you will, can help us understand how plants respond to extreme stress like heat, drought, disease, and really build that resilience into the crops ahead of time. So one of the topics I know you want to talk about today is how controlled environments research let us test those unthinkable scenarios like extreme heat, wind, drought, and it allows us to do that really safely and intentionally instead of discovering vulnerabilities the hard
Well, and Scott and Kay, I promise I'm going to bring you into the conversation in just a second, but it's not every day you get to talk to a doctor of plant biology and genetics. So I'm curious, April, with your experience, what's changed in plant breeding over, let's say, the past 20 to 30 years? I'd imagine there's quite a bit, right?
Quite a bit, absolutely. So, you know, the biggest shift is this concept that we call precision breeding at Bayer. We've moved from selecting the best from actually designing the best. So what I mean by that, traditional breeding kind of relied on crossing plants and selecting winners over hundreds of generations at times.
Wow.
But now this precision breeding concept is built around combining the knowledge of each plant's DNA and then combining that data with how the plants perform under controlled conditions and also with precise observations using really sophisticated cameras. But you imagine this creates a ton of data. So the big game changer has really been data science and now AI so that we can design these crops with more intention. So understanding the weather, tracking those environments and all this big data environment, we're able to test faster, we can simulate, we can learn faster, and we can skip breeding cycles entirely. And so that shortens the overall time to create a new variety dramatically.
So what's driving this? Where's the need, the acceleration for the need of innovation? Is it just climate change, or is there more?
Yeah, that's probably the biggest driver, but it's not the only one. I mean, we've known for decades that before we knew about climate change, that we were going to have a population growth problem. We also have greater expectations around sustainability that we need to really drive to be able to do more with less and with less inputs. There's also supply chain disruptions that add a lot of pressure as we globalize. But all of that has this expectation of speed. So we need solutions faster and science has to keep up. And I'm hoping that we can do that at the same pace or exceeding the pace of the changing climate.
No pressure, right? None at all.
Yeah, right. No. It's all just fun and games, right?
Yeah. Scott, how do research facilities help scientists simulate drought, heat stress, and disease pressure and things like that?
It's a great question, Brian. I think April touched upon it earlier. A little bit, the idea that, you know, we can create environments, you know, within the greenhouses that are not just greenhouse spaces, right? They're looking at how heat, how the amount of water that a crop gets, those types of things really are simulated in a safe and protected and purpose-built environment that allows that data to come to fruition versus learning the hard way, as was noted earlier, right? If you just go through a season and find out about that through a drought or through a lot of water coming at a different time. So, you know, what we try to do is create those environments in the actual greenhouse space that would mimic really some of these challenges that are being faced, right? Whether they're heat stress or droughts, those types of things, we have the ability to dial it in pretty precisely in these greenhouse spaces. And so we look at multiple scenarios at one time for the same crop as well. And I think that is really important to understand because our climate is also microclimate in certain ways in different environments. And so you want to see places where you might get a series of storms of water that come and one that gets a drought, and that could only be 100 miles away from each other.
Yeah, that's true.
And have the same crop. And so those things are really important to understand. Disease, the same way. Disease is borne by different avenues, sometimes by insects, sometimes by water being a part of that. They're all born in different ways, and trying to create that climate where those things either can occur, so we understand why it occurs and what its implications really are, or trying to resist it from occurring is another big part of that. So in those environments, it's really about trying to dial that in to go test those scenarios out. And the iterative process, which is what science is all about, and collection of data is really important now because we can go through that much more quickly than we did before and understand how to try to solve those problems in a much more real time kind of solution based process.
Interesting. So Kay, how does a phenotyping facility or a greenhouse become a controlled climate for answers?
Well, I think that's really interesting because sometimes I have to pull back and realize that not everybody has the level of science in their
right.
heads that we do, right? And so, you know, you take a greenhouse, for instance, and a lot of people, most people would say, oh yeah, I went there and picked up my flowers to plant, you know, this summer. And really, they're very complex facilities. They have integrated systems, kind of like what Scott was talking to. They have these integrated systems for the controlling of the watering of the plants, the what nutrients go into the water, so that they have that data that April was talking about, that they can substantiate findings for keeping the temperatures consistent and even the color temperature of the lights, so that they can mimic different climates and everything to help them really better understand how these environments are impacting plant growth. And really kind of the same thing with phenotyping facilities. April and I worked on the project, I think it was about 10 years ago at Purdue, and the plants there were not housed in a greenhouse. I believe it is now connected to the greenhouse, but everything was self-contained within this facility. And the plants actually lived in RFID tagged pots. And they all lived on a conveyor belt, so to speak. And they moved and all within this climate controlled growth house or growth chamber. And there they got the water that was specific, you know, with the specific nutrients, specific quantities. The temperature was controlled, the lighting was controlled. And what I found so fascinating in working with April and her team on this project was that then they moved along this control or this conveyor belt, and they were weighed, and then they moved into different cameras. They I think they had an RGB camera, and this thing would take a picture of the plant and plot points on the leaves, and then they would do that daily, and they could see what the impact of, you know, the different nutrients were on the plant. They would, one of them was like an x-ray, and it would look at the roots and how the roots were impacted by different things in the soil. And this is where they can really implement that data-driven decisions for, like April was saying, for finding that plant that they're going to take out into the climate, actual climate and plant.
Interesting. So I know Scott a minute ago mentioned it could be just 100 miles difference between a drought and a flood. And in fact, I think we got more snow in Indiana than you did in Denver, which is just the weirdest thing ever to me. But April, how does climate variability affect crop reliability across different U.S. regions?
Oh, yeah, it's a huge issue. And we're seeing much more regional variability than we used to see. What works in one state or even one season might fail the next. And so this is kind of due to extreme events. When climate change, when they were first talking about it as global warming, it sounded like it was going to be showing up evenly, spread like peanut butter across the globe with a few degrees temperature difference. And that doesn't really sound scary. And I think what we're actually seeing is that that's a global average. It's actually really showing up as extremes. So that means that plants also have to be able to withstand those extremes.
Right.
So our scientists, our plant breeders need better predictions about how our genetics will perform in these very different environments. So this is where those controlled environment experiments that simulate those extreme conditions, and where AI has become a real game changer. So with AI, we've been talking about how we're combining that genomics, the phenotyping, which is all those precise measurements from those different data sources, the x-ray, the cameras, the weather and environmental data, and then predicting that performance more accurately and sooner. So like, instead of just hoping that one variety will work everywhere in a region, we can actually design crops for specific conditions to get them to farmers faster, delivering those solutions even at a single field level with the precision planting equipment that we have to be able to get the right product on that right part of a farmer's field.
Wow. There's a lot going on here. What does resilience look like in plant science?
Resilience, I think that's a word that's on everybody's mind. And like I mentioned about using data, we have to be resilient in the face of climate change or in any kind of condition, we need to understand first the global environment and the weather patterns. So it's a huge data challenge, but then making certain that our genetics are going to perform reliably across that variability. So where we used to be all about optimizing yield under perfect conditions, it becomes more about preparing for uncertainties, like you mentioned, Scott, with disease that comes as part of natural life and in nature.
So, and Scott, April just mentioned, and my reaction was, wow, there's a lot going on here. So you've got a lot of different things and a lot of different people that are working on this. How do research environments encourage interdisciplinary collaboration?
Yeah, great question, Brian. I mean, I think we always seek to create environments that have that interdisciplinary collaboration. It's sort of built into the process with this work, because you look at the idea of creating a environment for this. You have plant engineers and scientists, you have data people, you have people that are running all the different parts of the systems of the building. And when you go to collect that kind of data, when we were looking at trying to create these different environments, and therefore whether it's simulating a drought or a heat wave or an immense amount of rainfall for some specific reason in a season, all those people are collaborating already to create those environments. That's the way you're dialing that in. So it's already kind of built into the process a little bit, but we certainly are looking to have all these people come and have a part of this in each of our different experimentations and thoughts through this. It's also about trying to create a common language about how they kind of communicate with each other and how that can then provide a feedback into the not only the process of the research, but also the things that are going on about creating that environment. So it takes a lot of people to do what this is and to create that environment specifically, but that interdisciplinary collaboration happens almost inherently, which is a really great positive to it, because there's so many different people that have to interact to create those things, and they're not really working in silos to create that specific kind of condition, which is a great part of it. The intent about that, though, too, is to ensure that we have some flexibility, because there is always going to be an evolution about this. So their feedback that they're bringing into this is going to create, and their collaboration is going to create the next thing. And so we want to have that environment, and whether that be a greenhouse to anything else, I'll be able to evolve with the things that are continued to be the challenges that we encounter.
So you just mentioned there's a lot of experts here that are not working in silos. Well, you're only an expert because you've studied and researched and done something for a really long time in one thing. So, Kay, my question is to bounce off that. How do you design spaces that break down those silos between, let's say, a plant scientist, geneticists, data analysts, veterinarians? How do you design for that?
Well, I've been doing this for a long time. And a few years ago, it sort of dawned on me that once a specimen is collected, whether it's a plant specimen or cells from an animal or cells from a human being, most of the science associated with that is that studying them is very similar. Mm. And so I think they all have DNA and RNA. They all have traits within that. One of the fascinating things that I think about is, say, like if you find a plant that is drought resistant, can you isolate that trait and then put that into a plant that isn't? And you can play off each other and help that plant be more drought resistant. But you think about it, the similarities between studying how environmental conditions impact cells, and that can translate to all forms of life. Yeah. You know, so I think the data, as we always go back to the data, right, April? And you go back to that,
right,
and it's transferable on many points, and it's a real starting point to sort of connect those things.
That's a perfect segue when you're talking about the data, and April, you've mentioned it several times already, but I want to hit a little bit more on this digital transformation in agriculture. How is data reshaping breeding cycles specifically?
Yeah, data is the key to all of it. And so if you think about plant breeding as a giant funnel, at the top you have millions of possible genetic combinations. Mm. But to be able to narrow that funnel down, the way that we used to do that was to test all of those different combinations and ideas in a field. but really only a small fraction can ever be physically tested. So data lets us narrow that funnel much earlier. So we can stop investing in ideas that aren't working and double down on the ones that are. So by making the predictions early on and helping us to design those crops that are going to be the most effective, it actually saves us years of effort, and it helps the teams to focus their energy on delivering better adapted crops to farmers with far less risk.
And is there a role that automation plays in accelerating discovery?
Great point. It's absolutely hand in hand. The automation actually brings us scale and enables consistency. Mm-hmm. By automating, we have less human bias, we have higher throughput, and these continuous data streams. When you pair automation and analytics together, our scientists can focus less on the routine aspects of collecting data and more on asking better questions, interpreting an unprecedented volume of results, and mm-hmm. designing better outcomes.
And Kay, you mentioned you and April both worked together on that greenhouse project at Purdue University. What makes the greenhouse a high-performance research facility versus a production greenhouse?
So greenhouses for production are really built to maximize yield and minimize cost. Well, let's get the healthiest plants we can out the door and into your local garden center to be able to sell as poinsettias or flowers, like Kay mentioned. So it's really all about the cost of production. And so many of the production greenhouses will have dirt floors. They'll have a little bit of extra supplemental lighting, but relying mostly on sunlight. In a research greenhouse, we build for precision, not volume. It's about repeatability and exquisite control and measurement of the environmental conditions, sensing and things like light, temperature, water, and timing. So every decision design supports experimentation and learning rather than just growing as many plants as possible.
What sort of design decisions most impact research outcomes?
I think probably flexibility is the most critical, because science changes daily. And by the time a design comes together, let alone the time it takes to get it built, the people change, the focus of the science changes. And as April was mentioning, that funnel and selecting which crops you want to really focus on, all of that can change in a few months, let alone a year or two. As we kind of spoke about the nutrients that go into the water systems, because they're able to specifically, as we talked about the water systems for the plants, you want that to be a very flexible system so that a variety of different nutrients can be implemented into the water and measured. So just the flexibility of adding different kinds of things to that, the ability to adjust temperatures up and down. I guess I always kind of thought of it as being giving them this ultimate climate to grow in, but really it's also giving them the most drastic climate, right? And seeing how they react to those environmental impacts. So that flexibility of being able to take the climate, heat and temperature and humidity and lighting, you know, to different extremes, I think is very important. So flexibility is probably key.
April, I'm curious, the greenhouse project at Purdue, how did that facility enable new research that might not have otherwise been possible?
That's exactly what it did. And what the researchers there have been able to do in the last 10 years since the facility was built has been just mind-blowing. But maybe a few examples. It allowed us to study stress and disease in a way that's simply not possible, or maybe not safe in some cases, in an open field. Mm. In a controlled environment like the facility there at Purdue, we can introduce an environmental stress or some experimental varieties, new genetics, or disease pressure. And we can do that deliberately and responsibly without risking spread or crop loss. It's also the level of control to run experiments year-round. You can get higher resolution trait data, and you can test hypotheses a lot faster. It's I guess, a safer, more predictable setting to look at extreme scenarios and learn before those conditions ever reach farmers' fields.
Let's talk a little bit about genetics and DNA and moving traits in order to set up another conversation that kind of intersects with discovery, design, and research. What does it mean to grab DNA from one plant and transfer it to another? How does that work?
Yeah, so it actually is a physical process, just like you describe it, Brian. First, we have to understand which traits matter for a given condition, and then identify the genetic drivers behind them. So the whole body of knowledge around plant biology and plant science is really important, even in the most basic conditions, to understand proteins or how cells operate, and then thinking about those traits and moving them intentionally. Like I said before, it used to be a trial and error, and now it's a purposeful design. I like to think about the difference between searching for a needle in a haystack to designing a needle that fit for a purpose.
That's interesting. I get the visual of like Captain America and Chris Evans being interjected with the super serum, and it's like increasing his muscle mass.
I wish it was that easy, bro. Yeah, I know.
So are there any misconceptions about genetic science and agriculture?
I think there's a lot of misconceptions, and a lot of people think that it's unnatural or risky, when really it's just an extension of what humans have done for centuries, but with more precision. So we've been unintentionally transforming the DNA of every species that we've interacted with. You think about how we have a poodle or a herding dog that came from a wolf. Well, those characteristics of herding or of being cute and fluffy are actually transferred in the DNA, and humans have been selecting for those traits, passing the DNA along generation over generation for 10,000 years or more. So the science itself here is very strong. But like I said, we're doing things with more precision, so it feels like we have a more direct control, even in an unnatural way. But it really is just more deliberate and direct. So I think the biggest challenge here is transparency and trust, and making sure that people understand what's actually happening, rather than having an emotional reaction to, I don't understand that, it sounds scary, so that they can make the right choices for themselves and their families.
That's a really good point. So I think those things help us shift. The last few minutes here has allowed us to shift from science a little bit more to a social impact. So how does innovation address food deserts?
Oh, great question. So like I said, yield alone, it doesn't solve access problems.
Right.
So having reliable, regionally adapted and affordable food supply matters just as much as yield. So while the food deserts and the supply chain issues are a little far removed from the specific R&D questions that I'm asking and answering, fortunately, there are research specialists in all aspects of the supply chains that supports the local food systems and improves the access. So we're thinking about it end to end, not just solving one little genetic question or one little cell hypothesis. We're actually thinking about how we impact people at a real human level in a day-to-day life.
And Scott, I think you know a little bit about this, but how do research institutions partner with communities?
Yeah, it's a key thing, because the work that's done in the lab or in the greenhouse needs to have a real world application. And so this real world application be almost a parallel study to some of the work that's going on in the greenhouse. And sometimes it's led by ideas that come out of that research and then put into a crop on a farmer's plot, and to see how that actually would work in its own way. But really, it's first about listening to what their needs are. And so those needs could be things that they're struggling with, whether it be a different disease challenge that they may have encountered and that may have only popped up in the last 5 or so years. It could be something that's related to the climate, and then trying to address that together with them. It's really that bridge back and forth, like I said, the research side, and then going and finding out and talking to the farmers themselves and the communities, and understanding the challenges that they have, and trying to bring that back and forth. It's this feedback loop. It's the data that you collect in the lab. It's the data that you collect out in the farmer's plot. Those two things together really give you an understanding of how this needs to move forward and how some things need to change in that process.
Can research facilities indirectly improve equity in food access?
I think so, absolutely. I mean, I think just the indirect part is that what we've talked about this entire time is finding those traits for certain plants to assist, help other plants be more drought tolerant or whatever. But I mean, you could imagine someone who lives in a very hot, humid climate can't have cantaloupe, right? Or something like that. And if you can find those traits, then all of a sudden that research has transposed into the field and they can. Or when we were doing the Bayer facility out in Woodland, California, I think, I remember seeing peppers that were just huge. And so if you can get your pepper plants to grow bigger fruits and vegetables, then you're helping with those inequities. Somebody could container garden something and get more production out of it. So I think it's all related. You can't have the success without the science and the facilities behind it.
April, is the bigger challenge in your mind production or distribution?
My research is focused on the production side of it. My colleagues that are dealing with the distribution challenges, I think, have a much heavier lift. So we produce a lot of food. And what I think is getting to us now is loss from logistics, infrastructure gaps that are probably bigger constraints than crop performance. So I love what you said, thinking about how we can grow plants in new environments. That's actually one of our main focuses in crop science R&D with Bayer, is to help farmers grow plants in environments that they might not have been able to do traditionally. I think though, solving those distribution questions is not just an R&D problem. It's about design, it's about policy, and really about systems. It's about design, it's about policy, and about systems thinking, not just better crops.
Scott and Kay, from your perspectives as architects and planners, how do you translate a scientist's mission, or someone like April's, into a physical space? So what's that purpose drive design look like in these discovery and research environments?
Yeah, it starts for us really in the asking the right questions. And that first question that we have to ask is why, and what their needs are, what they're trying to solve, right? And so when we go and do that, we start to understand not only the challenges that they're dealing with, but the things that they're trying to get to. And so it's obviously about their purpose, as it's always been, but it's trying to create a space that's physical, that doesn't get in the way of the science or what they're trying to do. We're really trying to create a purpose-built space that is adaptable, that is flexible, that allows them to continue to evolve their science, involve their research in whatever means it is, and then also forward to evolve as that goes forward. As we've talked about a couple times throughout this conversation today, it's an ever-changing thing, right? We want to create space that addresses the needs now and addresses the needs in the future.
Yeah, I love meeting the people and understanding how they want to work in their space, and just creating that space for them to be able to go in and do what makes them happy.
What breakthroughs in plant science are you most excited about that you've heard about or read about?
I like the volume that they're able to produce. You know, like I said earlier, going to Bayer and seeing these pepper plants that were like 10 feet tall with all these beautiful peppers on them was amazing. But I just, there's something so inherently pleasing when you know that you've contributed to something good in the world. You know, I can't grow the plants for them, but I can help give them great spaces to research.
I think I'm actually going to be a little more simple about it. I am just continually impressed about the research we've been able to do and the work we've been able to do to produce vegetables and fruits for people and get them to places that they weren't able to get to before, to give them nourishment, to give them choices, to give them food that was not available in the past because of the research and the changes that have been made about how we've bred certain plants to be tolerant in a way that they never were before, to ultimately feed people in a way that wasn't possible before in a sustainable way. To me, that's just exciting. It's the thing that we all hope for. We don't want people to not have choices, to not have access to food. And for us, that's whatever small contribution we can make through research, through creating spaces that allow for that to be possible, is for me a great contribution.
Well, I have access to a lot more of the specific innovation and information. Yeah. So I am going to talk about my favorite one, which is Bayer's new smart corn system, and it's called Preceon. So corn plants were historically bred to be very tall, like 9 feet or more. You probably heard the old adages of high as an elephant's eye by 4th of July, which is even taller than that now, because height was associated with yield. So there's a very strong genetic correlation there that the taller, bigger the plant is, the more that it can produce. But what our researchers have shown is that by understanding the plant's DNA and designing traits more precisely, you can grow corn that's much shorter, so closer to 6 feet tall or less, without sacrificing yield. So these shorter plants, you can imagine they're more resilient to extreme wind and other types of weather, and they also require fewer chemical inputs. So by being shorter, you can actually get, say, a more precise sprayer into the field for longer through the seasons without having to use an airplane to apply chemistry to treat disease. And so with the fewer inputs, the more sustainable approach, we allow the farmers to produce more efficiently and more sustainably. So this is just one of many innovations to come that kind of combines that precision breeding and DNA data, AI-enabled prediction that doesn't just change how we grow, but how the crops survive in a changing climate. And that product, like I said, called Preceon, will be coming to North America in 2027.
Wow.
So we're really excited about that.
Well, and it actually leads perfectly into my last question. So if you know me or listen to the show, I'm always going to ask some sort of future-driven question at the end. So in 20 years, how will the way we feed the world be different? And obviously, no one's going to hold you to these thoughts or predictions, but I'm just curious where your minds go.
So what comes to my mind is something that I heard some years ago while working with folks like April in the plant sciences was that I think I heard something to the effect of farmers will have to grow as much in 15 years to feed the world as they've grown since we became a husbandry society.
Mm.
And that's pretty mind-boggling.
Right.
So knowing that we can be a part of that and the science is going to help. I
would say it's around the idea of resiliency. All the things we've talked about is how we were making crops more resilient for them to be in multiple environments and be able to do that. I see that hopefully the future is one in which, you know, everything we're doing today, all the planning that we're doing, all the different genetic strains we're figuring out for our crops and things, allow that resiliency for us to almost kind of grow anything almost anywhere to some extent in a way that is very, very universal. And to that point, like Kay was just talking about, there's going to be such a significant need, we almost need to do that. It's almost like that's a guarantee that we
have to.
And I think it will change the way we feed the world in that process, hopefully.
I love the way that you guys have talked about these innovations and about the future. And I think it really is very bright for us. I think we've mentioned, all of us, that we'll think about the crops not just in isolation, but as part of a fully connected system. So from genetics, from growing conditions, all the way through harvest, distribution, and access. So we're going to rely much more heavily on simulations. And those simulations will need to include the weather. They'll need to include a deep understanding of the genetics and also of how different genetics perform under different weather conditions. And we're already there in many aspects.
Mm.
But I think the integrated simulations will get more and more robust and help us to make decisions earlier on that don't just ripple through the entire growing season, but that ripple through the entire supply chain. So we're thinking about ways that we can reduce risk and waste before food ever leaves a field. We'll have fewer surprises and more consistent outcomes for the farmers, suppliers, and communities, even as conditions continue to change.
Well, that's something certainly I look forward to. Thank you all for joining me. This was a great and fascinating conversation. And April, we sincerely appreciate you for taking the time to join us. We'll let you get back to it.
Lots to do. Thanks, Brian.
I'd like to thank April, Scott, and Kay again for joining me on this episode of BSA by Design. You can connect with them each on LinkedIn. If you want to learn more about BSA, we encourage you to visit our website at BSA Design. There's a link in the show notes to contact us for more information. and be sure to subscribe to BSA by Design on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube Music so you don't miss an episode. And be sure to check out BSA on social media, including LinkedIn and YouTube. That will do it for this episode. Join us again next time on BSA by Design.